Welcome to you all. My name is Joel Christensen, and I'll be one of two moderators tonight. We thought we needed two because of our topic tonight, which is going to be an honest talk about sets. I am here with my wife, Rebecca Wee, who is doing some poetry workshops up here at Holden. And I'm a teacher in Washington, D.C., and I teach middle school mathematics and social studies. And I have the dubious honor every year in the fall to bring my eighth grade boys together and have an honest talk about sex. And it's always very interesting. Right around that time, the hormones are kicking in, and it's about time that they do talk about sex in a very constructive, meaningful way. And I have found in talking with them that oftentimes they do not talk about sex at home, and they do not talk about sex in their churches, and they do not talk about sex with the family. And with something so all-encompassing in everyone's life, or in many people's lives, it seems like there is a real need to have open and honest discussion about it. So I hope that that can take place tonight. I thought it was very interesting when we were going over the ground rules, or how we were going to present this, we decided just to start by opening up the dictionary and look up the word sex. And so we did, and we found it very curious that in the definition, one definition was coitus, which means bringing together intimately two people, or just two. And then we looked down and we saw that the word was derived from the Latin word sexus, meaning to cut or divide. So I see that we have a wide range here of things, and that's what usually takes place when this topic is discussed. So that we don't have any problems, we'd like to keep tight control of this discussion as much as we can. So I'd like all of us to honor the ground rules, and these are those. Each one of our people in the panel are going to speak for 5 minutes. They have prepared some kind of talk. After that, during that, the first part of this, which will take a half an hour, we will just have these people speaking their mind for 5 minutes each, and there will be no participation from the audience. And then in the second half, we would like the audience to participate. And we would like to limit each person's question or statement to 2 minutes. And Carolyn and I will help you observe those boundaries. If the questions are specific questions to one of the panel members, we'd like you to speak directly to them and they can answer. If it's non-specific, we would like to field that those questions and ask one of our panel that we think would be appropriate to answer at that time. And then we'd like the panel members to keep it to 1 or 2 minutes so we can have as much participation as possible. And so that's my statement.
I'm Carolyn Horner. I'm the editor here, and I will cut to the quick so that we don't use more panel time. What I want to say to you is that the people who are sitting here in front of you today are willingly making themselves vulnerable to you. And I ask you to respect that and to honor that and to make that part of your interaction with this panel. We acknowledge that this is a volatile subject, and we ask you to acknowledge that and also to continue to honor and validate the vulnerabilities of those that are on the panel. So with that, the only other thing that I also want to underline is that when we do have the audience participation during the second half of the forum, that we want to have as many people as possible have the ability to interact with the panel members and to speak their piece. And so not only will we ask and help you to keep your comments within a minute or two, but also that if you have made a statement or made a question, that you then relinquish the floor from then on to anyone else that wants to do it so that we can have as many people participate as possible. We're going to introduce.
Let them introduce themselves.
Okay, I guess we'll introduce ourselves then.
My name is Gail Rossi and I'm a nurse here at Holden Village.
My name is Dan Narden. I am a college student, age 19.
My name is Jennifer Alonzito, and I'm 16 years old, and I go to Bellingham High School.
I'm Ed Marquardt. I'm a parish pastor from Seattle.
My name is Phyllis Zilhart. I work on staff at St. Francis Lutheran Church in San Francisco and also with Voice and Vision Lutheran Wesleyan Ministry.
I'm Julie Martinson. I'm the librarian on staff. I'm a retired English teacher, and we have been here for 6 years in the summer.
I will speak basically about kind of some of my growing up, some of my experiences, and then kind of my last part of my talk will be basically what is going on with me right now. I grew up in the 50s and 60s.
Please, we're having trouble hearing.
They can't hear you back there, so
okay.
Just speak up louder, Stan.
I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and the message that I got from my parents about good girls do not have sex outside of marriage. I did get married when I was 20. I did have sex before I did get married. However, my parents thought that I was this virgin, and my mother, when my father died, as I was sitting in the lawyer's office, found out that my parents had to get married because of my mother was pregnant with me at age 17. My mother had said that made a big production about their marriage, so that was sort of a shock to me. But she kept telling me as I was growing up that I should at least graduate from high school, and that would be the choice that I should get married and have children. I was married for 23 years. I had 3 daughters. My daughters were none of them, they all graduated from high school, none of them got pregnant, but I never really was able to talk to them, even though I did have some nursing background. It still seemed to be kind of difficult for me to talk to them about their sexuality, and my one daughter did come to me when she was about 16 and told me that she was sexually active, but she had gone and got on birth control pills, because I think a lot of the other kids talk about it, and so she knew that she should protect herself, and I was happy about that. My father died, and my mother, about a year later at age 55, my mother remarried, and she lived with a man, and she had told me all my growing up years, you know, you don't live with somebody unless you're married to them. She finally did get married at age 60 because my grandmother put the conditions on her that, you know, you get married, you don't live with somebody. After 23 years of marriage, I got divorced. And that's where I am. Want to talk about being always having these messages. Now here I am, a divorced person, being married for 23 years in a monogamous relationship, and now I'm divorced. And the situations that I encounter as a single woman, divorced, men trying to hit on me or trying to make me feel that, you know, I'm not a worthwhile person because, you know, I need to have sex. And then feeling like you are not a complete person if you're not married or if you're not in a relationship with somebody. Also, I think the love and belonging needs, I see a lot of sex as being sexual intercourse, where you are at a movie or whatever we see on TV, that sex is not just the act of sexual intercourse, but it's touching and holding and other kinds of things are people's sexuality. It does not necessarily mean that how do we express our sexuality, and I think there's other ways besides just actually the act of intercourse. As a nurse, I'd like to talk just a little bit briefly about that, in that a lot of people who go through diseases, many times they lose their sexuality, and there's a lot of feelings put on that, you know, you have to have sex, where there's other ways of, and I'm talking about sex in the fact of intercourse, there are other ways of expressing ourselves to people without, because people sometimes they have surgical procedures and they can't, their body image has changed, and sometimes we distance ourselves from those people. And how do those people feel about their, you know, their body image and their sexuality? I believe that the culture puts so much emphasis on sex, but there are other ways that we can show that to people. Particularly as we get older, we have sexual needs and love and belonging needs all through our lives, and that doesn't stop until death. And I think that's, you know, people have to realize that that is an important part of who we are.
My name is Dan, once again, and I'm going to be talking about how society has not only given us an image and controlled our thoughts about what sex should be and how we should feel about it, but also how the church has failed to guide us, especially the youth, through this society's turmoil. When sex first became an issue in society, it was society deemed it irresponsible, and it was very hush-hush, you know, and it discouraged it. But over time, somehow society made it okay to have sex, and not only do they make it okay, but they encourage it. You're a man if you have sex, you know, you're a woman if you have sex, and now we have 13-year-old men and women running around, you know, and I think that's wrong, because, and society has made it so that it's okay. The church, in its own regard, I feel, has been sent down by God as a beacon in the darkness, which is our sin. It's a beacon of His light, and I feel that the light should be spread so that we know where we're supposed to go and we're guided. I feel that the church has been so overbearing and critical about sex that instead of shining its light, it's covered. And so now, instead of seeing where we should be, all we see is the darkness through the church as well as through ourselves. And I'm going to read out of Matthew here, because it talks to me about how in covering its darkness, it's hypocritical of the church to judge others. And this is Matthew chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. "Judge not, that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or how wilt they say to thy brother, Let me pull out the mote out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye? Thou hypocrite, First cast out the beam of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast out the mote out of the brother's eye. I feel in this that Jesus is talking, and being that Jesus is God's son, he knows what he's talking about. And he's telling us that we need to not be hypocritical about how we guide others. And it is better, in my opinion, in conclusion, to not, as people, we need to set our guidelines, not to what society tells us is right, because society is always right. But instead, we need to set to our own personal convictions from what God has given us, from what God has given our parents to tell us, and from what God has given us as little hints and messages, for example, the Bible, or, you know, people that know what they're talking about, past experiences, parents. We need to learn from these resources instead of abusing them. And to the church, I feel it is better to shine your light and to teach and give understanding and learn yourselves. And I think it would be better to do this than to be the one to cast the first stone.
Hey, I'm Jennifer, and when I was asked to come here and talk about sex first, the first thing that came to my mind was the issue of respect, because being a young woman, that's a big issue in my life right now. When I say respect, I mean that I want to be seen as more than just a physical, you know, a physical girl, you know. I want to be seen as a, you know, somebody with brains and feelings and a real person. And when I say respect, I'm saying that I want to have a trust so that I know that I'm not going to be used. I want to know that when I say no, that I'm heard. This stuff is really, really important to me. If you have all this, I think that your physical relationship can be a lot more enjoyable, because it won't be so empty. There'll be a lot more to it, and it'll be a lot more special. When there's a lack of respect, I think that the women who have a lot of trouble saying no for whatever reason are really taken advantage of, and they can be hurt. And when a guy doesn't respect a girl, he can a lot of times label them as easy or loose and talk about that behind their back. And that's really sad to me. And to avoid that, I need to have a respect and a confidence in the guy that I'm with. And I want to be sure that they're not going to turn around and label me, and that they won't put me down behind my back. A really important value of mine is that I'm a really strong person inside. I think that to withstand the pressure from inside myself to be physical and from friends really shows strength. And if I see like a really attractive guy, you know, and I mean, I'm going to be really attracted to them and I'll want to do stuff with them, but so it's a lot of, it takes strength to just say, whoa, you know, I don't know this person. And I need to hold back for a minute before, you know, I need to earn this respect first. I think that through my own experience, I see that people are gonna like me more if I show this kind of strength, that they'll respect me more and kind of stuff. What I've been saying is not to put down like people my age that are sexual at all. Because when it's right, and it's their business, and it's their choice. So it's not really my business, but, okay, I'm not saying that I'm gonna wait months and months before I do something with a guy I really like, you know? But I think it's really dangerous to move really quickly with somebody before you really know who they are. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
My name is Ed. I've been here in the village now for 3 weeks, and every night after Vespers, I always go to the ice cream line, where you get the express line. There's always this handsome young man there doing ice cream cones. And every week there's five girls around him. And then there's each new week there's a new wave of girls that come in. I've been watching this. And so there's a new set of five girls every week. And this guy's just been having a great time. It's just that he loves Holden Village. So one night I say to the guy, I said, I think the hormones are stronger in you than the Holy Spirit. And he said to me, ain't it great? And I think that's a theme of God's towards sex. Ain't it great? I think that's what the Bible teaches. Ain't it great that God created such a wonderful gift for us, that he gave us this wonderful gift of sexuality. And all the church has hidden its message and not spoken it clearly. We as parents haven't communicated the way we should. You know, knowing that we fail in a thousand ways, I still think the fundamental message of the Bible is the gift of sexuality is one of the greatest gifts. And when that boy said the other night, ain't it great? I kind of resonated, thought back when I was his age, I thought, man, that guy's got a lot more going than I ever did. But I would say in my own marriage, in my own life as a person growing up, I've absolutely had wonderful times in my life as a sexual human being. The great marriage, I've been able to love a woman for a long, long time. I've been blessed with great, satisfying, wonderful, satisfying sexual experiences that are immense pleasure. Sex has been a vehicle of great love to express enormous intimacy between a man and a woman. We produce children. I mean, ain't it great? Ain't it great? The kid doesn't know how great it is, and he's only 15. So that's one side. And then there's the other side. I'm a working parish pastor. And so I see the same enjoyment, this God-given thing within sexuality. But I've been a parish pastor within the same church for 20 years. And so when you've been with somebody for 20 years, you've seen the other side, you see what happens when sexuality is abused. I've lived through the abortions. I've lived through the pregnancies. I've lived through the rapes. I've lived through the incest. I've lived through all the shit that happens within a family and within people's lives. Sex, ain't it great? It can be great. But at the same time, it can go the other direction just as strongly. And you just see the terrible scars. But what I have found through the years is that the healing is stronger than the scars. I have seen so much deep, enormously painful scars, but it amazes me, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years later, God heals those scars. So I say, even no matter how deep the deepest sexual scar in you, that too can be healed. I've seen it again and again. When I think of the Bible, I think for me the fundamental Bible verse is the thing is the sacred is a theme, and that sexuality is sacred. I like 1 Corinthians 6 where it says, "Don't you know that your bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit? Don't you know that? You know that? Your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. God has given you your body. Your body is not your own. Your body belongs to God. So glorify God with your body." I think that's absolutely true, that God has given us these wonderful gifts. Ain't it great? And it's to be used in such a way that our bodies are used to glorify God. Just a couple things I'd like to add is that for younger kids, it's epidemic teenage intercourse today. It's epidemic teenage pregnancy today. I know that in the year 1900, puberty was 15. Now it's 13 years old. I know kids are being much more sexually active. I know that kids see on average 9,000 sexually suggestive scenes per year on television. I almost think 9,000 a night on MTV, you know. It's just, holy cow, boys, how do you handle this? But all I know, there's enormous pressure on kids to be sexually active. I also know that kids are not using condoms the way that they were supposedly taught. And I know that 45% of the kids who are teenagers who get pregnant have abortions. I know that the kids who get pregnant as teenage, 71% of those girls end up on welfare. You know, this thing called teenage pregnancy is absolutely epidemic in our society, and it's enormously painful for many people in our society. And so I say to my kids at confirmation, be careful, don't go too far, too fast, too soon. Grow up a little bit. I still am convinced that where sexual love flourishes the best is in the safety and in the security of marital love. In the safety and the security and faithfulness of marital love. And it's in the safety of that relationship that I think that sexual love blossoms in such a way that that 15-year-old kid doesn't know how beautiful it's going to be, but he will discover, I hope, someday. Thank you.
My name again is Phyllis, and I have been in a relationship with a woman for next month. It'll be 9 years that we'll be together, and I'm very grateful for every one of those days. I just wanted to share with you a little bit about my struggle to get to joy and the wonder of that. The wonder of that journey that's still going on, but the joy that is mine. I grew up with a lot of negative messages around sexuality. Some of those were from the church small town in Minnesota where I was raised, and some of that was also through my family. My father was an active alcoholic when I was growing up, and I'm convinced that my mother was a product of incest, if not for her, at least within her family. And so there was lots of shame messages, negative body images that I inherited. And then what I also didn't realize was that I was also grappling with my own sexuality. I mean, if you're a baby dyke or something at age 10, I don't know. I was that, and yet I didn't really understand any of that either. So I had lots of conflicting feelings around what it meant to mature and to grow up and to be a sexual person, and I wasn't so sure that I wanted that. And I also was trying to fit in, and so I would date some young men through high school and college and even into seminary. But I always found that while the dating was going okay, I kept falling in love with my heterosexual women friends. And I had some wonderful friends, and they would say, well, you know, I love you too, Phyllis, but I don't think we mean it quite the same way. And I would be a little brokenhearted, and then these people wouldn't desert me, and they'd still be my friends, and we'd work it through, and many of them are still my friends now. So it was quite a journey for me to finally integrate my emotional feelings, my spiritual questioning, and my sexual journeying. And that finally happened for me late in my seminary career, which brought up lots of career issues for me, but which was wonderful in terms of my own life. And that was when I met Ruth and fell in love, and suddenly many things became clear for me. And I had some difficult decisions that I needed to make, but I knew I needed to follow what felt like was really a journey into wholeness, and that has become a tremendous journey into joy. And it's been a journey into healing for me from a lot of this family background and this split that I was talking about. And it's also been a journey into integration and growth and challenge for me. And part of the negative messages that I received, I was trying to figure out what does it really mean to say no and to say yes? I don't know that you can really say yes until you can really say no. What you were talking about, Jennifer, that, you know, unless you can really say that no, how do you know that you're really fully saying yes to an experience, to a relationship? And so a slogan for me that has been helpful is that the best way to have great sex is never to have sex, but to make love and to express your feelings of passion and compassion and togetherness. It's to listen and express that caring, to explore gratitude and giving, to take the risks in receiving, and to be honest in telling about your pleasures and your pains, your discomfort, your fantasies, your fears. It's to trust the grace of being embodied, to relax into the knowledge that beauty and desire grow with love, to grow in the freedom that commitment will open to you, and to tend an ongoing commitment to quality, not just a commitment to duration, And you will find that time will befriend you, seasons will flow through you, and forgiveness and renewal will support you. And it's a wonderful thing that I've discovered, that all that can be true and more. And I wanted to share just a little bit from my journal. This was written December 30th, 1991. As the cycle spins, once more the local laundromat offers a moment to pause, to reflect. I am on a mission of romance. New lush sheets for our Christmas bed were too coarse even after a holiday scrub. So on my one free night of the year with Ruth in Phoenix, I plot surprise softness for tomorrow's welcome home tryst. A special trip to the grocery store guaranteed the blessing of Downey. I scarcely comprehend the passage of another year of time in San Francisco, of my partnering with Ruth, of my own life, of the world saga. What a saga, war, carnage, political revolution, poverty, homelessness, love, parting, passing, parting, passing, and birthing. Several people that I ministered to this year have died, Walt, Bill, David, and others I saw less frequently. Letting go or being taken, all departed earth for the land of the dead. May the bridge to them, for all be love. As Thornton Wilder proclaimed, there is a land of the living and there is a land of the dead. The bridge is love, the ultimate meaning, the only survival. Couples broke up too, Francoise and Colleen last year. This year, Mark and Cindy, Patty and Diane. Patty and Diane shocked us all, mostly by speaking the truth, I think. They were together for 8 years, and I must have sensed Patty's discontent, for I was shocked, but not surprised. Under the pleasant words and loving phrases, I heard a deep, grinding irritation. I felt their love and comfort, but not their bliss. It annoyed me because I recognized my own lack of bliss. After a trip to Minnesota, I became very moody and jumpy. My passion for lovemaking was asleep. Little pebbles of irritation ground ugly blisters. I missed connections to family and friends. I longed for intimacy beyond Ruth. I craved alone time, hungered for moments of my own. How are we healed? The dawn rose in piercing beauty. Ruth's touch found the grain of my body and spirit. Her presence soothed and saved. I gloried in her mouth, her eyes, her hips. I started to fall in love again, as a gift alone. Often our love is too joined to an office, a ministry, to being odd icons. May love bear fruit in labor and works of justice, but may love conceive in grace alone.
I'm Ruby, and I was born in 1935, so I was born back, or I was part of that generation and background of people that didn't really talk about sex. My childhood was not a very usual childhood. My mother died when I was four, and in 1939, the world was not in very good shape at that time. My father could not keep our family together. We had several children, there were about six of us. And so he left with two of the boys, two of the older boys, and the rest of us were kind of farmed out. And I was farmed out to different people for quite a number of times, or quite a while. And then when I was a second grader, I was taken into a welfare home. And I eventually was adopted by that family when I was a fifth grader. But it was a dysfunctional family. They were a wonderful family to take in all these welfare children, but there was not any kind of a love relationship between the father and the mother to teach the children what love is about. The mother, they never slept together. The father slept in the bedroom and the mother slept in her house dress on the Davenport every night. And so, you know, we always knew that there was no really close relationship. He was a butcher. He would come home late at 9 o'clock or so in the evening, and then he would make his own supper, and then he would go to bed. And it was, I'm sure it must have been an extremely lonely existence for him when I think about that. My mother was a, quote, writer, and she told us at times that her intellectual life had transported her interest in any kind of a sexual relationship. So more or less letting us know as children that sex was not important. And I really never felt a part of that family, although I was adopted into it and as a fifth grader, and remained with them until I grew up. But I think I was always looking for a family. I wanted a family myself. And I did have contact once in a while with my own real blood relatives, but I never really felt part of them either because there was too much separation. So basically what I looked for when I got married was a family. That's what I wanted. And so we ended up, when we got married, we had a child within that first year. And then we had three more, in 4 years we had three children. And that's what I wanted. And the sex wasn't as important as the closeness of the relationship and, you know, having the family, having the children. And the relationship that we have established, I think, is good. It is fine. Sex has always been important as far as our life is concerned, but it's not been an overpowering passion, you know, type thing. As far as our own children and trying to talk to them about sex, I had never been talked to about sex by my family, by my parents. So it was not something that was comfortable for me when my children were growing up, especially my three older children. Then 6 years later, we had an additional child. We had our daughter, and we had another daughter. And it seemed like it was the relationship there. Well, one thing, that she was alone, basically. I mean, the others were 10, you know, when she was born, one was 10, one was 8 and a half, and one was 6 and a half or something like that. So she was more or less of an only child, and it was easier for me. I didn't have all that work. I'm taking care of three small children so that I could enjoy that baby. And I think our relationship is probably closer, you know, with that child. And she was the only one that I was ever able to talk about sex with. And she came to me about it, though. And when she was graduating from high school and going off to college, and she had been going with a young man for over 2 years, and they were going to be going to college in the same town, and so she wanted to get some birth control, and so we talked about it, and so that was the only child that I was ever able to talk to about sex. So I took her to a woman doctor who was wonderful and gave. She did such a wonderful job of doing what I should have been able to do, and I always felt that because we were able to at least communicate on that, it made us closer together. And I'm still married. We still have four children and several grandchildren, and I think we're sort of happy.
All right. Shall we now open it up to questions and statements from the audience? Something that you'd like to discuss that has been brought up here?
I just wanted to share an experience that Phyllis and I had with her younger brother, Neil. He would come to visit us from a small town in Canby, and he was in high school, but he had a lot of trouble with depression. So he ended up missing 3 years of high school because he was very claustrophobic and he had to study at home. So when he went off to college, he was socially 3 years behind his peers, and a bundle of raging hormones I mean, he was ready to explode. We knew that it was only a matter of probably days before Neil was going to be sexual. So he couldn't talk to him. He couldn't talk to his parents, but he figured a couple of lesbians were safe. He wanted to know all about sex, and so it became our task to educate. And one of the things that I realized is that, as you were commenting earlier, we have so much focus on sexual intercourse as sex. That's what defines sex. And one of the things that we were able to do with Neil, which say, because obviously lesbians don't have sexual intercourse in the same way that heterosexual couples do, we were able to talk to Neil about all the ways that he could experience the pleasure of his own body and the pleasure of young women's bodies in a respectful, caring relationship. It was kind of the 101 ways you can have orgasm without penetration. and it was our chief concern that Neil learn the hazards of STDs and pregnancy and AIDS. And yet, we knew that to tell him, just be abstinent, don't get sexual, wouldn't work. He was going to get sexual. So I think that part of our task is to look at the ways that we are full-bodied sexual persons without always concentrating on sexual intercourse as the definitive concept of what it means to be sexual and intimate with one another. And it could be that lesbians and gay men and heterosexual people can learn a lot from talking to each other about how we are intimate with one another, because I think we would come up with a better notion of the full range of human intimacy.
Thanks. There was a question up here, wasn't there?
I was mulling over an idea as I listened to her second from the left, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, and second from the right. In their speaking, I noticed there's a great stereotype and a great generalization that is perhaps true, and I won't argue with it, that it seems it is the woman who says when, and she's the one that decides when there's going to be sex and when there isn't. When she's the one that's going to say yes, and you can't say yes until you've said no or something. And I was wondering if any of the panelists or the second from the left who's doing the social or society's aspects of it, if there's any comments as to why that would be. Is it the hormones? Is it society? Or is there another answer to it?
Who's the second from the left?
Are you talking about Jennifer? Yes.
No, I'm talking about her because I noticed in her speech she was generalizing that.
Talking about me?
Yes, and then you were the one.
Okay. The first thing, let me clear up some terms here. He and she.
Jennifer's your name?
Yeah.
And what's your name?
Dan.
Okay, in Jennifer's speech, she was referring, said it's her decision when to say when. But I noticed at the beginning you mentioned that you were doing society's views of it and the social aspect of it. So I was wondering if you might be able to comment as to why you might think that that stereotype is true.
I don't. And I'm going to have to say that I have a lot of friends who are girls, a lot of friends who are guys. And I've heard a lot more from girls as far as a sensitive type of response to sex, sexual, guys coming on to them when they don't really want them to, However, I mean, from my own personal experiences and from, those of my friends, I mean, there are plenty of girls out there that come on to guys that don't necessarily want sex, I think that generally, I can say from my own experiences that, yeah, I have seen more of guys coming on to girls and girls who have to say when, but I don't think that I can say that statistically or factually, because I mean, I know from my own personal experiences, it goes both ways, And I think that society tells us that it's guys that are supposed to come on to the girls, but I think this is an excellent, example of how society is wrong.
Okay, when I was talking for my own personal experiences, And so when I was talking a lot about guys coming on to girls, it was like, you know, I was just, you know, thinking of my own personal experiences, but I know it goes both ways a lot of times.
Well, I understand why the no in regards to the to women should be respected, because the men don't get pregnant. And if the man is not responsible to be able to be responsible for his actions, they should be able to respect the no's.
That's a good point.
Yeah. That's fair. Question back?
A comment. I have heard repeatedly, and I really resonate with it, that so much of sex and lovemaking is other than the physical and the intercourse. My wife and I are here. We came here for our honeymoon with our two teenage children. One of them is that 15-year-old boy.
Eat your heart off, Dad.
And the first thing that happened is they put my wife and I in two different rooms, six rooms down the hall from each other. And when we finally do get together in the same room, it's all four of us in the pan. What I found was that it's such a refreshing honeymoon, because in counseling there is a saying that it rings so true, that if my mouth won't speak it, my body will. And I don't think that we teach our children how to speak about sex, how to speak about intimacy, how to share that with our mouths. And so if they're not going to with their mouths, eventually they're going to do it with their bodies. And I think that the more that we can do that with each other, as new husband and wife, the more refreshing it is for us. And the more that we can share that and express that to teenagers, the better chance that they'll have growing up and healthy. Thanks.
Thank you.
I find it quite interesting with my dealings with the parents of my students, is that during the ages that I see them and beyond, kids don't really want to listen to their parents all that much. So then I wonder how this communication is going to happen when something innate says that it won't happen very well or very easily. And I was just curious how families deal with that when a child doesn't really want to listen to what has to be said. Where are they going to get their information? And how does that, how can you maybe better communication, or just to throw out an issue that I find interesting? Yes.
Well, I don't have a clear answer to that, but I think one thing that happens is that you start very young talking about sexuality to your kids, and you do it over and over at different stages in a different kind of relationship as you get older and as your child is older with you. And so you don't just suddenly do this at age 12 or suddenly at age 17. It should be part of some kind of dialogue going all the time about how you treat one another. And I really do resonate with Jennifer's thesis about mutual respect. And one of the areas in which I think the church failed in the generation that I am part of and earlier is that in a married relationship, mostly women were to love their husbands, love and respect their husbands. Husbands were to love the wives. The respect word was left out, and I've heard sermons about that, and I really think there needs to be a mutuality going on. But I also was really relating to Ruth and Phyllis in this whole context and wondering about these things that we can learn from one another. There's been parts of everybody's comments that I really believe and relate to, and the only thing that I got stopped at, Ed, was the point where you said in marital relationship is this true relationship. And yet, we in the church disallow ceremony for gay lesbian people. And so I'm wondering about that. Because obviously, many gay and lesbian people have very fine and profound relationships, but they have to do it without ceremony because of how the rest of us define that.
And I believe that that also goes for the divorced person or the widowed person who has been married for 25 years, has been widowed, and now all of a sudden they have to start all over dating, thinking about sexually transmitted diseases, getting to know this partner, particularly for somebody like me who grew up in some of the messages, and now all of a sudden, you know, I don't really know if I really agree that marriage is the only place that you can be, that, you know, marital intimacy is the only bliss. Because I think with some of you people that are here, maybe you're married, but maybe at one particular time you were divorced and you had to go through starting to date all over and, you know, distancing yourself, trusting, going through a lot of the stuff that a lot of these young people here are doing, and you're doing it at age 30, 40, 50 years old.
I would like to share with an experience about my daughter. She and I got along very well until about the time her hormones turned on. And then there was no communication or anything, and I realized that I was not going to know when she needed birth control and everything. So I just told her, I said, when you get ready and you need to go to the health department for your birth control pills or whatever, I said, that's fine, but I said, I want to know when you do that. You don't have to talk about it if you don't want to, but because she was really not talking to me at all. We were just way perfect. So I got a phone call at work one day. Mom, I'm on my way to the health department. Will you please go with me? and it seemed at that time then that things opened up again. I don't know why.
And you were supportive then of that decision?
I felt I had to be. I didn't feel like I wanted to say, I mean, if she was sexually active or she was going to be, yeah, the health department was giving free stuff.
Yeah, I would just like to, I mean, the idea of parents talking to their children about sex, I think is right on. I really agree with that. I can't say how much more I agree with it than that. But I would like to reiterate something that hasn't really been said. It's the way that parents go about talking to their children about sex, because it's very easy, I've seen, that parents are overbearing on their children. They're coming down on their children in such a way that you will not have sex until you are 25 years of age, and you know, you will not do this and you will not do that, and I'm not going to support you in that or tell you about it because it's not going to happen. And they are so, I see parents as being frightened because, you know, sex is very big in our society, you know, and I know if I were a parent, I would be just terrified because, you know, what are you going to do? You know, you have to do it in a way that your children are going to listen, because to put it bluntly, if you can't communicate to your children, no matter how much you think you've scared them, society will snatch them up and it will rape them of all their innocence. And it's just as plain as that.
Okay. I think the concept of bad girls, good girls is an awful, it's an abomination, really. And it's lack of education, lack of knowledge, particularly on the boys' side. I remember growing up, and you know, there were bad girls and good girls, and I always want the good girls, darn it, but you know. But anyways, you know, it's to me, it's a terrible thing. And one thing I saw a statistic a while back that made me say that there's something really wrong. That in Europe, the teenage birth rate is 1/10 of it as the United States. And yet over there, they think they have a lot more sex knowledge than we do here in the United States. So clearly something's messages. The message of your message, the message on TV, are apparently bunding together, and everybody's sort of scared and still doing their, you know, when it gets down there, no, I'm not going to put the condom on, or no, I'm not to whatever, and no, I'm not going to say no, or whatever, right? So there's something really, I think, wrong.
In our society?
Yeah. Because of that.
Coming back to education of our children, I can't even come close to what it's like to be a parent, but I think teaching children involves understanding what we're talking about and trying to teach, and part of understanding is overcoming fears. And parents themselves, in order to teach children about sex and sexuality, need to overcome their own fears, because, you know, they were children once too, and it was a scary thing because their parents were scared and never taught them, and it's a circle, and no fear equals understanding equals education.
I have a question. Is there anybody on the panel who would be willing to address the issues of how does one's sexuality develop differently if sexual abuse has been part of your childhood?
Could you repeat that question?
How does one's sexuality or expression of sexuality develop differently if sexual abuse has been part of your childhood? Not just the TV rape, but I mean actual in your own life directly.
Well, I can address that firsthand. I was sexually molested when I was about 9 years old, I think, by this man who didn't live in our town but was there for part of the summer, and it was a very frightening thing for me, and I didn't at all feel that I could talk to my parents about this, so I didn't tell anyone about it for quite a number of years. And for me it was, you know, there were lots of confusing messages, as I was saying, about shame in my own body and sexuality anyway, so it's a little hard for me to, you know, distill what was what with all that, but I think that's also a part of what adds to a child's vulnerability in those situations. I'm not saying that my parents were to blame for that, what that man did, but I think there's also a lot of self-esteem. Children, as we were talking about, you know, talk to them early on. There's a lot of workshops about good touch, bad touch, you know, what children want, what feels good, what they don't want. I've got little nieces who, you know, they just know those things, and it's great. And so I didn't have any of that in terms of my own boundaries or self-esteem or whatever. And I think it has affected me. And yet I also know, as Ed was saying, that there can be healing as well. And for me, it has been wonderful to be with Ruth, who has been very understanding, because even so, in a very loving, respectful relationships, bodies are wonderful reservoirs of memory, and we remember loving touch, and I think that influences us. And talking about nurturing your baby, you know, that affects us throughout her life, as does abusive touch. And so there are times when, once in a while, Ruth and I will be making love, and it just happens to be just the wrong little movement, whatever, and I'll just have a moment of discomfort or whatever, and I'll just have a flashback. And I haven't had that for a long time, but when we were first together, I had a lot of that kind of, and suddenly I was back somewhere else. And it took us quite a while to figure out, how do you work through that sexual healing? How does that really happen? And I think it isn't just talking about it is important, but really being loved through that into a new concept of your body and into safety is really important. So I think it has a tremendous effect on the one hand, and yet I also know
that there can be healing and understanding and a capacity for grace to realize that things are ongoing in terms of dynamics, but that there can be a lot of growth and healing too.
I'd like to answer a question that you had. It says here, as husbands and wives, be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. Talking about how husbands are to treat their wives, it says that husbands are to cherish their wives. A marriage counselor told me that means to keep warm and make soft. So I think, you know, the perhaps feminist anger or, you know, the subjective thing really needs to look at that husbands have a role to love and cherish. That's one thing. The next thing I'm going to say is going to perhaps offend, but I really don't mean it to, in that the Bible tells us a lot about what's right and wrong in sex. It tells us that adultery is wrong. It tells us that fornication is wrong. And it tells us that homosexuality is wrong. And I don't mean any attack, but it gently does tell us that, you know, the Lord wants you to follow a certain way. And if you ignore that, you may have respect and warmth and goodness in that way, but it's not what the Lord wants, and that's why the church cannot do that. Yeah, it's going to be the Church of Jesus.
Yeah, but the Lord also tells you not to wear fabrics of mixed of fiber and to not eat pork. And these come from Leviticus, which is the time of the purification of the people of Israel. And they are of that time, as we all are. We all live in our time.
So what you're trying to say is that fornication and adultery and all of these other things are okay because that was then and this is now?
No. What I would add to that is that I don't think any kind of exploitive or abusive relationship is all right in the eyes of God or of Jesus. And that goes for heterosexual or homosexual love. I think that Jesus, if he were here today, would be in the middle of the disenfranchised people and the people pushed to the margins of the society.
Yes.
And
Wait, please, one at a time.
And I think that's what he expects of us, that we also champion the people who are marginalized.
Now, Del, just wait. I don't know if you were here at the beginning, but we have to. You've already had your statement, so I want to ask, first of all, if anyone else would like to speak on this or something else. Okay, we'll go down here.
I'd like to offer the challenge to people who think in the way that homosexuality is a choice. Recently in the Journal of Science, this is a highly respected scientific journal, they did a study among homosexual men, and they found a common gene on the X chromosome inheritable by the mother, from the mother. And I'd like to challenge the church that if they don't discriminate against eye color, green, blue, or brown, and that if science ultimately finds that homosexuality is an inheritable trait, which is not a choice, but rather a biological entity, how in the heck is the church going to deal with this when other biological entities are not discriminated against in the church? It's an open question, but it's likely to head that direction.
Allison?
I just also wanted to add that, okay. When the Bible was written, it was written a long, long time ago before they knew any of this stuff. I mean, just think about that for a minute.
So we're just saying,
no, just wait. Allison?
I guess I have two comments. One is that I understood this discussion tonight to be an evening of talking out of our own experiences and truth-telling, and was not meant in any way to be a setting down of rules or moralizing on one side of an issue or another. I guess I would be disappointed to see this discussion turn into an argument about rights and wrongs rather than being an open discussion about what experiences are and whether or not we have all had experiences like one another's or understand them or would like them or not. I guess I'd like to stay out of that realm and save it for a different type of forum. I definitely think it's something really important to be talked about, and it is another thing that the church and our culture doesn't talk about enough and should be addressed, but I think that wasn't the goal of this evening's talk. My other comment comes back to what this man is saying up here right in front of me about some of the differences between Europe and American experiences and what's going on. I read an article about a year ago that was about an actor from Europe who came to the United States and has become an American citizen and has been doing acting and was commenting on one of the dramatic differences in the media in Europe and in the United States. I think the media is where a lot of us get our messages from about how we interact with each other on a lot of different levels, the movies and television. And he said that in Europe, the violence that is depicted daily in the United States would never be tolerated. The TV and movie industries are much more intolerant of violence toward anyone, and yet at the same time where the United States will not show any kind of sexual act unless you know the ratings go up and you can't see it until you're older and everything else. In Europe there are much looser controls over what kind of sexual interactions can happen between people. And he said one thing that he's amazed about is that you never see a married couple being sexual at all on the television in the United States. And, you know, even the Huxtables, you know, the great American family, they sit in bed together and sometimes they chat, but you never see any kind of anything that resembles the lovemaking that has been spoken about tonight. There's a difference between having sex and lovemaking, and there's a lot of violence and abuse and sexual innuendo that is not respectful, that is all over the screens all the time over here, and you don't see any kind of lovemaking. And that is, you know, you aren't allowed in this country to see people loving one another in an intimate way.
We can either stop now or we can continue for a few more minutes. Do you want to continue or should we?
Right. Okay, so maybe if we have two or three more, and then if you want the discussion to go on, you can, you know, take it to the hotel or something. Because I guess there's going to be a showing of Claymation here.
Well, actually, I mean, you know, this one's over.
It's rough.
Because I thought that was my habit anyway.
Okay. Okay, let's take, is the woman in the front? Go ahead.
I just want to tell you that I teach sex ed in the school, I'm a school nurse, and I have an excellent video that Colleen Mask has put out called Sex Respect. I don't know if anyone's heard of it.
Called what?
Sex Respect. And she talks about the term secondary virginity, and I guess I'd like to bring that up because there are a lot of young people in here, and I like to use that when I talk with my students, because for kids who have become sexually active, they used to always say, once sexually active, always sexually active. Mm-hmm. Get them on birth control pills, you know, they're going to be, they say no, that this secondary virginity, it's like being a recovering alcoholic. You can say, this is not working in my life. I have things I want to do now. I have skills I need to develop. I have relationships I want to grow in, and I'm going to put this on hold until I get into a loving, mature relationship, until I've completed these life tasks that I need to do. Then I will make my choice to become sexually active again. And I just like to throw that.
Thank you very much.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because that was exactly the phrase I was going to bring up, secondary virginity, the same thing. But what I thought was most interesting, that it took a school teacher from a public school to bring this up. And what I have found sometimes is that the church doesn't have the courage anymore to talk about a certain type of sexual value, such as secondary virginity, or such as mutual monogamy and things like that. And that's a conversation that we have with lots of our young people in our church who've been very sexually active, and they're finding that isn't working. And there's something about, like, all of God's good gifts, for them to develop to the greatest fruition, there needs to be limits, boundaries. It's at the essence of freedom, is boundaries and limits. And it somehow makes things so well. And so what you have said about secondary virginity, I think that's a wonderful phrase, and would encourage people who have been sexually active to take a look at it. It's one thing I'd like to say. And then also, it's the nature of my life, Jesus, you work with such a varied expression, and so many people are living together. You know, and I work with literally hundreds of couples who are living together in all ages, from very young to older. But what I have found is that most people aren't really secure in that living together relationship. And as a relationship develops, that there seems to be wanting a deeper commitment, that living together isn't enough. There seems to be a need for some kind of covenant with each other. And that's where I go back to my comment, or earlier comment, where it seems to me where sexuality and sexual love blossoms the fullest is in a covenant relationship with each other. And I find that people who are living together are often groping towards that direction. And as their relationship develops, almost always and inevitably, they come and say, Pastor, you know, this needs marriage in order for it to grow more. So I still argue with it, and am persuaded by the validity of that biblical perspective.
That's it.
I wanted to return to Carol's question briefly about abuse and how it affects a person's sexuality. And I wanted to say something about, we've been talking about lack of communication and where society or where the church might fail us. And I think on the issue of rape and date rape, I think a lot of times people can't talk about it. And instead, they don't realize that someone's sexuality is impacted for the rest of their lives, because it's something that they had no control over. And I think, sorry.
Don't apologize.
I think that it's really too bad that our society cannot communicate, can't talk about it. They're so afraid. It's bad enough that parents are afraid to tell their kids about sex. And I'm not blaming the parents, because I know their parents didn't tell them. That's bad enough, but then when somebody is raped, to feel so guilty that you can't go to anyone else because it's your fault, because that's the way that it's made out to be. Statistics say that one out of five women will be raped in their life. That includes stranger rape, date rape, acquaintance rape. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, look at how many women are in this room. That's a fifth of everybody that's in this room. And most of those people won't have anyone that they can talk to about. And there's a lot of healing that has to be done to have a healthy sexual relationship after that. And men aren't educated to understand how to deal with the woman who's gone through that. And they can try, but it's really hard. And I think that society needs to learn to talk about it. They need to be able to. I think it's amazing that we can be having this conversation now. But I think that people need to think about the different kinds of abuses and the different kinds of communication that's not happening. And something needs to be done, because you won't go into unhealthy sexual relationships for the rest of your life if something doesn't change somewhere.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that my experience is with a lot of disillusionment in the church because of this thought that you can't have sex until you get married, and that you have to be married to be with someone, and you can't live with someone, and it's a sin, and you're going to go to hell, and it's this type of thing where, although I'm still growing, and all my life I used to think that that's the way it was going to be, and that's why I tend not to want to go back to the church. Not that I'm not going to church now, but I feel I do it out of duty more than anything. I just feel sometimes lost in the sense that I can't talk to someone about maybe living with a guy, maybe being with a guy, and maybe having that be a loving, caring relationship without having to have that paper or that ring that says that you're with someone. I knew a couple that was together for 20 years and they never got married, and they finally got married for the first time last year, and it was a great thing, you know, and maybe it sounds kind of sad, but the only reason they got married was for financial reasons, because it wasn't because they didn't feel they were committed fully to each other. But it kind of scares me that why do we have this belief that, you know, like the Bible says that we're supposed to be married in order to have a relationship with someone. And I understand, I do put a limit on the sexual activities of people, because I don't feel that when you're 13 you really know what you're doing, or when you're 15 that you really know what you're doing. Maybe there's a lot of 15-year-olds who might disagree with me. But I feel that as you get older, it's not so feasible that you're going to get married and that you're going to have kids. And your sexuality starts to run rampant, and you're thinking, I'm going to go to hell if I have sex with this guy. And it just seems kind of sad that you have this feeling. And I don't know if this is just my feeling with the church or if it's a shared feeling. And I just threw that out to, you know, wonder what's going on.
I would like to make a comment on that. Being a nurse and working in a large hospital and watching numerous married couples and the way they treated each other, never touching each other, never showing intimacy, these people are dying and they're married, myself included in that, and knowing that you could not leave that marriage because you could be excommunicated from the church because you were divorced. And I guess I really don't agree with your comment that just because you live together and you have a close relationship, and if you're not married, that you don't have an intimate, close relationship. Because I see many people, and I talk to many people, many patients have shared with me, they've been married long, long periods of time, and they're trapped, they're angry, they've never got a lot of their needs met, but they stay in these marriages. So I don't agree that marriage is the only solution, and that is, you can get your needs met and not have to be married.
I didn't say that. What I said is that a loving marriage, a non-abusive loving marriage, where there's security over time, is the place where it seems that sexual love blossoms in the fullest way. I didn't say that you cannot have good relationships elsewhere. I know, hey, if anybody knows, I know marriages can be the other side. And I think I know that just as well as you do. I work with it every day professionally. So I didn't say that. But what I am trying to say is that in a loving marriage, not abusive, where there is security over time, it's that long security which allows love to blossom in a special way. And if that can happen, that's wonderful. Now, it's not saying that love and sexual love can't help happen elsewhere. It just seems to me in that garden is where love grows the best. That's all I'm saying.
Whether that relationship is held together by a covenant written and blessed by the church, the important part is that those two people have made a commitment to each other. They honor that commitment above their personal gratification, their personal rights. I hear so much today about, I have a right to this, I have a right to that. But when you've entered into a relationship with another person, that is secondary. The relationship is the important thing. And if you don't have that commitment, if you don't stick with it, the relationship is nothing.
Just changing the subject dramatically here for a moment and going back to something we touched on before, I agree with what people are saying about mutual respect and mutual understanding and whether you believe it needs to be in a covenant or ordained or blessed by the church or whatever. Something that as a nurse I really feel strongly about is that I think that for people who then choose to go on with physical intercourse, we need to provide a means for people to protect themselves. We have a lot of young adults up here, we have older adults up here, and there's no opportunity in this village to get a condom. And I really think that as a community that we should, there's an unofficial route at the moment, but I think that as a community that this is something we should address, something that we should talk to the board of directors about. There's any number of options you can go. I know that Winter Community talked about it this year, but it is part of this honest discussion about sex, because there are going to be people who are going to choose to have physical intercourse, and I really think that this day and age, it's a burning issue. And I encourage you all to support this.
People have been floating around the idea of where's the church in all this, and currently within the Lutheran Church there's a working document floating around about sexuality, and many criticisms have been floating around about it because it seems to challenge the working understandings of sexuality and relationships among genders and all types of things related to sexuality. And I'd just be curious to maybe throw it to the panel, if any of you have read it, or people in the audience, what are their thoughts about this document, and if they feel that the church should adopt this, or any related comment to that document. Because I think this is exactly what we're talking about. Granted, it's something that's going through the upper channels, and it's not really accomplishing what we need to do in our day-to-day relationships in terms of educating people and talking and understanding sexuality. But it does something in terms of, it tells us something about what the church is trying to do. So,
I'd like to speak to that because in our Bible study group, we studied this document and it wasn't a statement. It was some gathering of information as different theologians saw it. But what it did was challenge us to discuss it, and then we had an evaluation form to turn in to the church if we cared to, and we were to discuss it then in the larger group in the church. Unfortunately, that didn't occur in our church, although we requested it, I guess because some people were uncomfortable with that. But personally, it helped me address, I think, homosexuality I had put as something I didn't really need to think about, that I didn't want to really know too much about it. And I came to the conclusion that I think I've heard here tonight that, that this is something that we should be able to come to some kind of covenant or commitment that the church blesses, that when two people come together, that they, if they choose to have a committed relationship, that we should be able to bless it. And I think that, and I expressed that in my evaluation to the church as well. But it helped me in that area that I
finally came to terms with the fact that there are gay and lesbian people living in committed relationships and the church ignores them.
Thank you.
But it was
thank
the challenge
you.
About masturbation. It didn't even mention. I think it mentioned. It used that word once in the whole thing. It's something that we've discussed in a sense tonight.
Thank you very much. We're going to have to wrap this up now. I would like to, and I know we all would like to, thank you very much for your participation. And the panel, thank you for your bravery and your contributions.
Looking all around, I was just very excited to see a forum that incorporated and got together so many different age groups, and I want to thank everyone from the youngest to the oldest.